Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Today I'm with Andrew Hollingworth of Holland Advisors, who provide investment analysis services to European fund managers and CIOs, whilst also running their own investment fund. Andrew, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background and why you started Holland Advisors?
My background, gosh, that goes back a long way. So I started in the business a very long time ago. I was 18 years old. Before the stock market crashed in 1987, I came straight out of school, didn't go to university, and started in a back office function. So sort of really started at the very sort of beginnings, if you like, and started in sort of a junior equity function and just really learned on the job and just sort of did a variety of different jobs in equity roles. And really received no sort of formal training, just worked from sort of job to job, working through different sort of equity analysis roles, fund management roles, learning how to analyze companies, learning about sort of market cycles. In all truth, seeing quite a lot of people get fired between 1987 and 1992, which is not what other people's experiences might have been if they joined in 2003 or 2010. I just sort of learned as I went along. And as I say, I saw quite a lot of market cycles, saw quite a lot of different ways to analyze companies, learned a lot about rights issues, which is something that's been quite relevant recently, but not what you saw a lot in sort of previous periods of time. And then it wasn't really until probably I was perhaps got to the age of about 30 also that I really found a sort of compass or found a sort of religion, if you like. Because having had not any great formal training, it wasn't until I got to that sort of age that I found sort of Buffett and Munger and Fisher and all those sort of guys. And then I really started, then I sort of found this sort of belief and sort of thought, well, hang on, okay, this is what I should be doing. This is sort of, I'm interested in selling stocks and shares, and I'm interested in, you know, the sales job and the fund management that I've been doing, but this is how I should be doing it. And that was what sort of got set me on a path of thinking I should be self-employed, because thinking I should sort of get out of the slightly sort of crazy, unnecessarily busy, transaction-orientated world of the city to being more self-employed, because I could see that's how people like Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett had been more disciplined and learned more about how to lead their lives, if you like. And so I was sitting at a desk at Redburn at the time, and I had a file on my desk, which I'm not sure I've admitted this in public, but the file was called the Reach the Woods file. And so in that file, I would put anything that was about setting up my own business. And now and again, my boss would come around and sit and chat to me, and he would sit on the Reach the Woods file, and we would chat about something or other. But that would have things in it about setting up my own company. And then at a point in time in the future, I decided it was time to set up my own company. And that is what's become Holland Advisors. So I set up Holland in 2008. And what we do, as you very kindly mentioned in your introduction, is we write investment research for some of the largest sort of fund management companies in the country and in the world, in terms of providing them sort of, if you like, wholesale investment ideas. And then we also run our own investment fund as well. So I suppose what we do, I've never really thought about it this way, but we did some work on Boohoo recently, and I've known Ted Baker years ago. And both of those companies came about in their life by being wholesalers that became retailers. And I'd never really thought about myself that way before, but I suppose that's sort of what we did. I spent a lot of my career being a wholesale provider of ideas to the fund management industry. And in the last 7 or 8 years, I've then run a sort of effectively a retail fund, for want of a better description. And that's what I suppose I've done, is I've been a wholesaler providing ideas into the other fund managers that run funds in the London stock market. And now we are providing more of a retail product as well. So those are the two things that we do as a company. But yeah, I've been doing this job in some shape or form for quite a long time.
So how's the fund performed over the last 7 years?
So we've actually been going longer than seven. I think I might have said seven. We've been going for nine. So we started at the end of 2011. We're up 80%, which someone mentioned it to me the other day. I didn't realize this, that we're almost exactly the same performance as the FT Yorkshire, which I hadn't really realized in total return, which is okay. I mean, we're a value biased fund. So a lot of value funds haven't performed very well. So I suppose to have matched the FT Yorkshire is fine. And certainly at the beginning of me running money, there was a bit of experimentation going on. I'm a huge Buffett fan, and we did some sort of workout type stuff. We did some deep value stuff. And in the last 3 or 4 years, maybe 4 or 5 years, we've become much, much more disciplined in looking for sort of undervalued owner-manager compounding type businesses. So I think having done a bit of experimentation at the beginning, I feel pretty happy that we've ended up with a sort of decent sort of compounded return. And in all truth, we don't really think about it from a benchmark perspective. We think about it from an absolute return perspective, and to have eked out sort of 80% total return over a 9-year period is acceptable. It's not, you know, we think we could do a sort of 12, 13, 14% compound return. If we look at the types of businesses we own and the compound return they make over time, we think that is a perfectly achievable thing to do. So we're behind that in terms of where we come from today. But, you know, we learn a lot as we go along. We've made mistakes like other people have. And we have had a value bias during a period of time in which growth has massively outperformed, as everyone knows. So, you know, we're okay with how we've got to where we've got to. And we really like what we've got as starting from today.
And how do you feel about value investing as against growth investing? Because, as you say, it's not been so much in vogue and not given such good performance.
I think it's all a bit of a misnomer, really. I don't really like the titles, if I'm honest. I think what we try to do is we try to find businesses that are mispriced for the compounding they will ultimately achieve, and in that, that I think really is the game. And in some cases, that can be a business that is going to grow extremely fast, and you're paying a fair multiple for that extremely fast growth. And we invested a little bit of money in Boohoo last year. It's probably the highest price multiple we've ever paid for a share. But Boohoo's growing at a phenomenal growth rate. The auditors might not like it last year because they slightly fell out of love with it, but that was the opportunity that presented itself. In other companies, we would never pay that price for a share. But then other companies are not growing at that rate. So generally there is a trade-off, obviously, between that growth and the price that you'll pay for it. I think generally it's just right to be more skeptical of the growth of a business and therefore to be more cautious on the price you're going to pay for it. And that's generally what we are doing. It's just saying, look, we just don't want to overpay for future growth because future growth just might not happen as people expect. And we are more inclined to look at businesses that have got proven historical rates of growth that are much, much more repeatable in businesses that are much more repeatable, like a Ryanair or a Wetherspoons or those sorts of businesses that are not going to be changed dramatically by technology, let's say. And if we think we can then invest in those businesses at a really acceptable price and can look at the compounding we're going to get from those businesses, well, not so much is going to go wrong. And we can model those businesses in absolute levels of return and so look at the absolute multiple we're paying for those cash flows and the absolute returns that we're going to get, which is why we then don't look at the fund from a relative perspective. We look at the fund from an absolute return perspective as well. So I don't really like this whole sort of, I'm a growth investor, I'm a value investor. When somebody gives you money to invest and when you give them money back at the end of the period, you can't give them relative money to spend on their school fees or relative money to spend on their cruise and their pension fund. You can just give them absolute money. So you can't give them a ticket that says, well, I'm really sorry I'm giving you half the money back that you gave me, but I did really well in comparison to all other growth investors. It doesn't work like that. So I just sort of don't really believe in the misnomer. So yeah, you have to sort of couch to other investors, we sort of did okay because we're value investors and we did okay because we're growth investors against this sort of backdrop. But at the end of the day, did you do a good or a bad job with my money, that the absolute return matters. So that's, I know that's not an answer to your question, but that's what I believe in.
Mind you, with Wetherspoons or Ryanair, 2020 was quite a difficult year. No one would have ever imagined what happened, did happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to say, well, yeah, it was a difficult year. If you looked at our portfolio going into 2020, it was, well, we couldn't have designed a worse portfolio to go into 2020 with. It was almost, if you'd have said to me, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen with 2020, and I'd like you to invent a short portfolio to go into 2020 with, we had it absolutely perfectly. So yeah, it was quite challenging from that perspective, actually. Yeah, I mean, our experiences of that were really quite interesting. I mean, one thing that we have done that I suppose I'm quite proud of, actually, and I think probably comes a little bit out of the research that we've done historically. We mostly do company research. And the research that we publish and effectively sell to other fund managers is in-depth company research. And that informs, obviously, the investments we make in our funds. But we do a certain amount of macroeconomic research as well. And in fact, if anyone wants the macroeconomic research, we give out for free. So if anyone wants our macroeconomic research, they can sign up on the front page of our website. But we don't write macroeconomic research all the time. And the reason we don't is because it's two a penny. You can buy the Financial Times, The Economist, and get it for free. We write macroeconomic research when we think there is something to say. And I will be slightly immodest for a minute. And if you look back onto our website and read what we wrote in 2007, you can read what we wrote about the credit crunch before the credit crunch happened. Okay. And we also, you can look at what we said on Twitter in January and February about coronavirus as well. So we look at the macro world. And the way we describe this is a bit like the wing mirrors in a car, in the sense that when I'm driving in a car, I spend 90% of my time trying not to run anybody over. I spend quite a lot of my time thinking about turning left and right, but I do also look in my wing mirrors to make sure there isn't a tornado behind me. But I don't look in my wing mirrors very often. And that's how we run portfolio monies. And now and again, if you see something in your wing mirrors, we do respond to it. Now, it doesn't happen very often, but it does happen occasionally. And to us, COVID-19 was that. And it wasn't so much the fact that it was definitely going to be a major problem. It was the fact that nobody was responding to it in the Western world at all. And to us, Mark and I sort of talked about it a lot in January. And then early February came and the stock market was at an all-time high, and then it was at an all-time high. And we were like, what the bleep is going on? And long story short, we went to 20% cash in February. We sold lots of our airlines. We sold lots of our pubs. We sold all of our Formula One. And yes, we should have gone 50% cash, but we didn't. And, you know, with the portfolio we had, we should have been down probably 50, 60% peak to trough. We'd be down 35 or something. You know, and it feels good that we didn't go down more. It feels dreadful by the fact that we saw it coming and we still lost a lot of money on the way down. So you never get it right. You never, ever, ever get it right. And it feels dreadful when you're losing money. But I don't know, part of the job is to try and see these things coming a little bit and to try and just not lose quite as much money for your clients as you would otherwise. But Tamsin, you know what it's like. You just try and you still get it wrong.
And with your mandate, can you go to 50% cash or not?
In the fund we run in currently, we could have done, actually. I mean, we do run, you know, we could have gone to 50% cash if we wanted to, but we do try and run the current fund in a very, so we're about to convert to a UCITS fund next year, which we can talk about later on if you want. But we do run it in a very sort of institutional way is wrong, but we try and run it in a very grown up way. We don't run four stocks or something ridiculous. We run 25 holdings. There are one or two smaller companies in there, but it's largely large liquid businesses. So the fund is properly audited. You know, so it, we are running it like a business that would then be replicable in a much larger sum of money. So, you know, if I thought 50% cash was the right decision, I could have done it. So I can't hide behind a regulatory structure that says I couldn't have done that. I could have done in the structure that we've got. I just wasn't brave enough to do it. And also at the time, I thought it, because in Asia, it had been a short effect. And I suppose the mistake we made is that we went to 20% cash and then we reinvested back in May time thinking that was it, because it had been a short effect. I'd never dreamed it would be as long and lasting as it's been in the West. That was the mistake. That was one of numerous mistakes we could talk about for hours if you'd like to.
So how do you deal with it psychologically when you have such drawdown and you're dealing with your client's money? You know, it's bad enough when it's your own portfolio. How did you deal with that?
I think the first thing you've got to do is you've got to talk to people. So we had a conference call. I have some wonderful clients actually who bizarrely never want to talk to me. I mean, I can assume that's the obvious reason, but generally we write what I think are really open communicative letters twice a year. And we don't really talk to people very much. They don't want to talk to us particularly. But so I've never had a sort of conference call, but I did have a conference call. I think it was April, just to say, there's a lot going on. We've lost a lot of money from peak to trough. Let's have a conference call. And so, and I think nearly everybody or a lot of people dialed into that. And it was open also to people that were potential investors who had looked at investing with us. So quite a number of people dialed in, just because I'd never done it before, but it was just seemed the right thing to do. You just got to give transparency and you just say, this is what's happening. This is what we're doing. We went to cash, but it wasn't enough. You know, this is the stocks. This is what we think is going on, you know, and it feels dreadful when you're doing it, but you have to, because, and the second thing I'd say is I think there's a lot of theory about how to cope with these sort of downturns. The practical reality of how to cope with them is being old helps, as in, I don't mean just being old for the sake of it. I mean, being through many other downturns helps. So earlier on, I mentioned about the fact that I started pre the 1987 crash. So I've done 87, I've done the 1990s downturn, I've done, you know, the 2001, I've done 2008. It helps. It helps a lot because you have seen it before, you know, and that for anyone that hasn't been through one of these or has only been through one of them or two of them, if you think that helps because it means that you just tiptoe your way through beautifully and you just go, oh, well, I'll just call the bottom and I'll invest all my cash at the bottom, it'll be nice and easy. It's just nonsense. It's just nonsense. You will make horrific mistakes. You just make slightly less mistakes than you made in the last one. And I was thinking about this the other day, actually, is that I think you have to enjoy them as well. You definitely don't enjoy them during the time. You definitely don't enjoy them during the time. No matter how much experience you've got, they are really stressful during the period. And they're stressful because you are losing people money, but they're also stressful because you are unbelievably busy. Because you're really busy analyzing the companies you've got, because you were modeling a business looking at the profitability it's going into the future. Suddenly you're now modeling it. So all of that profit forecast is irrelevant. It's now all about solvency and capital adequacy and all the rest of it for every company in your, well, not every company, but for a number of the companies in your portfolio. But at the same time, loads of stocks you thought were very interesting have all gone down in value by 65%. So you're trying to analyze 50 new companies in a week. So your workload has just gone up by 100-fold. So you're really busy and probably quite stressed. And so if you're not, then you're probably not doing a job right. So you can't hide from that you're busy and stressed, and that goes on for quite a long periods of time. And anyone that's ever looked or read any book about stress and decision-making knows that you make the worst decisions when you're under stress. So it's a disaster in terms of combination. So for me, I think the combination of having been through previous crisis helped, because you at least know what's coming, and you know that you will make mistakes and it feels dreadful, but you might just survive. I also think actually some of the mental models of Munger and Buffett and all these sort of guys helps a bit, because every now and again, something comes into your head, like, you know, I don't know, a stock that you can't decide whether you're going to buy it, whether you're not going to buy it, you know, because it's fallen a long way and you think it looks cheap and you can't decide how brave to be. And then in your head pops Warren Buffett, who says, reach for a bucket, not a thimble. And you might have done a spreadsheet on it, you might not have done, but you've always wanted to buy the shares. And that little, you know, angel on your shoulder makes the difference between you owning 5% of your fund and 1% of your fund. And that's it. Or you feeling really stressed one day is the difference between Charlie Munger's twin track analysis, which is that whole idea of what are you doing and how are you feeling, if you like. So I just think all these little things contribute to you sort of just getting through these periods. But I do think, I think afterwards you have to look back and go, I think I sort of enjoyed that because that's sort of what I'm trained for. And the last thing I'd say is, I think I've never been, and this may be a disrespectful analogy, and I please hopefully nobody take it the way, I've never been to war. But I think it's probably a bit like a soldier, if you like, in the sense that I think any soldier that you speak to, and I've got a good friend of mine who's that, and I think that's sort of what you're trained for. I think, you know, during 2008, 2009, you know, it was a fascinating period of time to be an investor and a stock market analyst and economist, because that's sort of what you're trained for. And I think if you're not any good during those periods of time, in some shape or form, either holding your nerve or writing research or thinking or helping your clients, doing something that you can do well, maybe you're in the wrong job.
So retrospectively, what were you happy about what you did last year and what would you have changed?
Oh, I'm pleased. I'm really pleased we saw it coming. I'm so disappointed we didn't go to more cash, because it would have a dramatic difference to our performance, because it would have really, you know, if we'd have gone to 40% cash and stayed there for another month, our performance would look really, really different. We've recovered really well, but it would have looked dramatically different. So that's a shame. And that's not a dramatic difference, but it would have made a dramatic difference to the outcome. What we did well, we really called some of the bottom in some of the sort of stocks we've wanted for a long time. So businesses like Greggs, for example. So we bought quite a lot of Greggs at about £11. So what this period has done actually is help us sort of right a few wrongs. And by that I mean is that there are one or two shares that in the early years of the fund we liked and we owned, and we were dumb enough to sell for various reasons that involve me being an idiot or foolish enough to want to do something else with the money and just a bit impatient, you know. And they are stocks like Greggs, stocks like Jet2, just because I owned them, liked them, saw the compounding power, and just moved on and did something else. But I always admired them. I always admired their compounding power, always admired the franchising, the returns on capital, fact they did a great job for their customer. So they have always been on the radar. And what this year did is it gave me another opportunity to buy those businesses. And in fact, I think when you and I had a conversation a year ago, I remember distinctly you were asking me, what is your biggest mistake? I think you asked me something like, what's your best investment? And then you asked me, what's your best mistake? And it was the same answer. My best investment was Dark Group, and my biggest mistake was Dark Group. One was buying it and one was selling it. Well, this year, we bought Jet2, which was Dark Group, at a phenomenal price, which is on screen, and we still own it now.
What did you get it at?
Different prices, but they all start with sort of sixes, generally. So, yeah, fantastic. I said that'd be about an average, it would be in the sixes, which is great in comparison to the price that's on the screen now. So those have been really good for us in terms of the ability to, one, sort of pick those sort of stocks throughout the summer, and two, being able to not just buy businesses that will recover and then we'll be flogging in 6 months' time, but to be able to reinvest in businesses that we think are good quality businesses that have got certainly in Jet2's case, an aligned owner manager that we could own for quite a good period of time and could have some really good sort of compounding powers in them. So yeah, we're delighted to have had a chance to buy back into some really good quality companies again.
So where do you see the opportunities for 2021, either sector or company specific?
I think it's quite it's always interesting on the outlook, but I think the market's sort of polarized in the sense you've obviously got the sort of secular growth brigade who are tied to the sort of secular growth of technology and high growth rates, and whether they are or aren't sort of effectively arbitraging off of extremely low interest rates, and they were doing extremely well pre-COVID and then have carried on doing extremely well post-COVID and all the rest of it. And they seem to be sort of still carrying on doing what they're doing and are delighted by that. And a lot of the stuff you're seeing in the States in terms of flotation suggests that that carries on. That's just a world that we are so far away from because the margin of safety looks non-existent in that to us. So it's not that we don't see the growth. It's not that we don't see that those businesses are interesting. I even read a piece of research on Snowflake about a month or so ago. Looks like a really interesting business, but I just don't want to pay whatever it is, 20 times sales for something. So there is obviously that trend going on. It looks pretty stretched to us in terms of there being any real value in that. And maybe there's a bump in the road to come in that, but that's not something that we're terribly interested in. And does it really affect what we do? Probably not. There's the other side of the stock market, which is obviously the sort of recovery stroke, cyclical recovery from COVID, if you like, which is very interesting to see what happened when the vaccine news came out and actually how small number of fund managers performed really well post the vaccine. And there was a small group of people, and you can look them up in terms of the London fund managers that performed really strongly post vaccine, and it is not very many. And certainly we were being sort of almost questioned for our sanity pre the vaccine on some of the shares that we own, because we owned quite a lot of consumer recovery shares. And certainly we didn't expect the vaccine news to come out as soon as it did, but we did think that at some point, probably in the spring, COVID would run its course and some of these businesses would recover. And importantly, if their cash burn wasn't so bad in the case of, say, Greggs, then these businesses would recover in their full potential. What's interesting is that, yes, you've seen those businesses now recover, but what happens after this? And we wrote a piece of research, which is freely available on our website, called the Mo Farah Recovery Portfolio. And in that, what we've tried to talk about is, the analogy is, long distance runners, they turn up every year. The margin between the winner and the second place and the third place is incredibly small with all the training they do and all the nutrition they do and so on. And just if you turned up one year and the guy that's in second place had got sort of nobbled by a competitor and the guy that's in third place had got sort of injured, if you like, then someone like Mo Farah could win by a mile. And he would remark as he crossed the finish line, where have all my competitors gone? And there's a bit of that going on right now with effectively, COVID-19. And you don't necessarily see it because some of the businesses that are failing, sadly, are not quoted. And so if you look at below the surface, so for example, in Greggs's case, a lot of the business that Greggs compete with are London-based sandwich shops that are not necessarily quoted, that may not come back, and if they do come back, will not be anything like as strong as they were. Another example, which we don't own in the portfolio, is Whitbread. Whitbread's main business is Premier Inn. Premier Inn disclosed last summer that its market share for Premier Inn was up dramatically, something like 20% over last summer, which is a dramatic change in its market share over such a short period of time, because its biggest competitors were either in financial trouble, backed by private equity, or a mum and pop hoteliers who are really, really struggling because of the pandemic. And those sort of market share shifts are probably not going to go away anytime soon. And it's the same for Jet2. We think that the travel industry is being sort of decimated by this, and the strong will get stronger and the weak will get weaker. So I think it's very easy to look at share prices and say, oh, well, that stock's recovered back to where it was, so that's fine. But that might not take into account that you're going to see market share shifts and businesses could end up being much stronger than they were. And, you know, the whole sort of mentality of, you know, to the victor goes the spoils. You know, these businesses could end up being much stronger, much more profitable 2-3 years from now. And that's what we're looking at. And I think it's you want to focus on those types of businesses and not be in a rush to sell them, frankly.
But something like Greggs, the valuation on it now is looking quite stretched, wouldn't you say?
I think it doesn't look cheap as cheap anymore. But I think the other thing you need to be a bit careful of is, I don't know if you saw what they said in the trading statement yesterday. So they said in the trading statement yesterday that 5.5% of their sales are now coming from Just Eat Delivery. Okay. They only launched Just Eat Delivery in September. So it's quite an interesting statistic, I think. Not only because you've just created a new arm for your business effectively in 3 months, but also, you know, so what will that percentage of your sales be in a year's time or 2 years' time? Okay. What's the marginal profitability of that to this business? Could be significant. Okay. And also, how does the stock market think about that? So how does the stock market think about this old, slightly tired, slightly boring high street business that is dying because it's in the high street and no one goes to the high street anymore? Well, now it's a fashionable business because now it's being able to be part of the home delivery network. And if you want an example of that, go to the States and look at Chipotle, which is the sort of Mexican wrap business. So this was a business that's healthy food eating. Everyone loved it. And then it had a sort of health scare crisis about 3 or 4 years ago. And then an activist bought a stake in it. Business started to recover, started to stabilize, and it really nailed home delivery. You look at the share price now, it's like a growth stock. It's absolutely on fire because it's absolutely mastered the home delivery. But what you need is you need a brand. You need the relationship, excuse me, with the customer. You need the customer to really like that product. And then you need to get the product to the place where the customer wants it. Now, what's really important in Greggs' case is Greggs was talking about this long before the pandemic happened. It's all over the last reporting accounts. It's all over about let's get home delivery sorted out. Let's get the product where the customer wants it. I can quote a statistic from the reporting accounts that says that only 5% of Greggs sales are happening where the customer is, basically, i.e. when they pass the shop. That's from their reporting accounts. So they were basically saying, let's make sure we can get the product to the other 95% of where the customer is happening, spending their time. So they were already thinking about moving the product to where the customer is. So the fact that they've managed to accelerate that so quickly with COVID is a really good sign.
And how much are you modelling? What percentage are you modelling that they'll get through that conduit?
We're not. That's the lovely thing about having managers that you... Greggs isn't an owner-managed business in the sense there isn't a large stake in it owned by a founder, which is unusual from our perspective. But I think the management team is really, we like them. We think they're really sort of, they run the business as if they were. And I think we're just very happy to let them pan that out. And I think what we don't try and do in the businesses that we have is try to be exacting in our forecasting of the future. And if there's one thing I've learned from sort of the time spent at sort of Berkshire Hathaway meetings and listening to Charlie and Warren and all the rest of it, is we spend a lot of time thinking about businesses or understanding businesses' pasts to try and understand their future. But trying to model their future in exacting detail, we don't do that. So we're really happy to spend time in the summer that says, do we think Greggs is in a pretty strong position to be able to take its product to a home delivery market? Yes, we do. And do we think it would be in a really strong position to take its brand to Just Eat or anybody else and say, we will do a very good commercial deal with you because we have a brand that you're going to want to take and the customer's going to want, and you're not going to take too much of the economics from us? Yes, we do. And we're very happy to have made that decision. But do we need to forecast that in such minute detail? No, we don't. Now, might there come a time in Greggs' share price in the future where the expectation of the stock market is so outrageous and so ridiculous that we might have to make that? Well, we might, but we're a long way from that yet.
Do you have a target price?
No. Tamsin, we're not even back to where the share price was. You know, we are we're 6 months on from a pandemic. We haven't even reopened half the stores. That's not how we. The job is to try and buy great businesses when everyone else puts them on sale and then not sell them. And that's what we're doing.
Brilliant. Andrew, thank you very much. Can you tell us where people can find you and find out more about the fund?
Sure. Yeah. If they go onto our website, there's quite a lot of information on the website. For people that are interested, there's an investor education section on there, all about how to be a better investor, how to think better, that sort of stuff. It's all free. They can also sign up to get either investor letters from us or get the investment research from us, which is all free. In terms of the investment fund is converting to be available to UK investors from next, no, not next year, now this year. So this February or March. So up to now, it's only been available to professional investors, but we're converting it to a UCITS fund that will then be available from this February or March. So if you're interested in that, then sign up on the website on the front page, and when that conversion takes place, we'll get back in touch with you. But there's a lot of information on the website. It's all freely available. Sign up to get updates, or just look through some of the research that's available there. We hope you find it of use.
Many thanks, Andrew. And to everyone listening, there are many more of these investor interviews on piworld.co.uk. In the meantime, stay well.
PIWorld videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PIWorld is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.